or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Gratitude. It's a common Christmas term we're supposed to feel around the holidays. And so I figured that on this pre-Christmas show, I would, I've got to tie the thing into work somehow. So we're going to look at a question. Should we feel gratitude about the U.S. workplace or resentment toward it? It's easy to find fault with it, but, especially at the Christmas season, I'm going to try to put away my inner curmudgeonly self and share in the spirit of the days that await us. And because I can't count on myself to do that well enough myself, I decided to bring in our little Santa-like spirit of Christmas. The Napa County Superintendent of School, in the last 3 weeks, she was named one of the 5 technology leading superintendents of the nation, and in a separate poll, top 40 technology superintendents of the nation, previous superintendent of the year, and my wife, that's her most important, accolade, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Thanks for joining me.
Just call me Little Susie Sunshine.
Yes. No, well, little Grinch, little elf, little happy elf for Christmas. Is that right? Anyway, so I thought a fun way to start this would be I am going to lay out the case, and it'll take maybe 5 minutes. I'm going to lay out the case for why, and you can interrupt, because you do anyway. So I'm going to lay out the case for why I think we should, in fact, really feel gratitude, good Christmas gratitude for the American workplace. And then you can play Scrooge or the Lorax or a Grinch or whatever and tell us why that's bah humbug. Okay?
I think I can do that.
All right. Now, again, I can't resist starting with a little negative. I mean, it's really easy to find.
So much for talking about all the things you're grateful for. I think I'll just start with a little negative.
Lest I be seen as a Pollyanna.
Not to worry.
I mean, seriously, ever more job. I mean, because if I sound too puffy, there's a lot of pain out there in the workplace. And there are many, many people who are struggling, including at this time of year, who get layoff notices right before Christmas. Ever more jobs are being reduced to part-time jobs, temp jobs, crappy pay jobs, no benefit jobs. And in fact, family income in real dollars, inflation adjusted, is down to its lowest level in almost 2 decades. So, I don't want, dear listeners who are struggling, I don't want you to think that I'm just, in delusion land about how wonderful things are in the workplace. But there is positive, and that's the case I want to make today. Most American workplaces have heat, even air conditioning. We take for granted the availability of reliable technology, from that electricity to the phone to the internet. Even fairly small workplaces have fat rules of conduct that are usually followed, and there's procedures in-house as well as legal to deal with grievances. That ain't the case in the whole world. Most American employers subsidize health care for their workers before Obamacare, and now it's going to even be more of them. And workers get workers' compensation, Social Security, Medicare, sick days, vacation days, the Family and Medical Leave Act, paid leave for up to 12 weeks a year here in California, the Americans with Disabilities Act, which provides protections for everything from depression to cancer, plus 20 separate bases on which you can file claims for wrongful termination, sexual harassment. So in the American workplace, there's a hell of a lot of rights and benefits that don't exist in most of the world. And even though American wages are declining in real dollars, average per capita income, the average per capita income of $38,000 is still well above the worldwide average of $18,000. And I think that probably few of you would trade your salary with that for the average Bangladeshi, for example. Just last week, Pope Francis called wages in Bangladesh akin to, quote, slave labor. What are those wages? $50 a month. And speaking of Bangladesh, many of the factories are really their death traps. In April, 400 people died when a factory collapsed. And in just the last few months of 2012, lest you think that I'm saying, you know, just cherry-picking that as one bad example, faulty wiring, short circuit, stuff like that caused 18 conflagrations just in their clothing factories, including one where 111 people died. A study found that the U.S. worker accident rate is one-fifth of that of Bangladesh and less than half the rate in China and India. Now, inadvertent worker injury is one thing, but deliberate injury is another. Bloomberg, and which is now, you know, Business Week and Bloomberg are one, they reported last month rampant beatings of illegal immigrant workers in Saudi Arabia, including with machetes. Now, some Americans aren't fans of illegal immigration to the U.S., but there aren't any reports of macheting, last I heard. And America, yes, union membership is declining, but it's not because police are shooting at striking union members. That did, however, occur last year in South Africa. In the U.S., unions continue to extract impressive salary and benefit deals. For example, the blue-collar workers, the AFL-CIO, the basic service providers, SEIU, government employees, the National Federation of Federal Employees, the teachers, AFT. Speaking of teachers, do you know that the average salary for an elementary school and teacher on Long Island is $82,050 average, plus summers off, vacation time, full benefits, job security for life after just 2 years, and you come here to California and you take the low cost of living, Fresno, which is one of the lowest cost cities in California, the average teacher makes $70,710. And right here in San Francisco, you start at $50,000 with just a BA and the 30 units required for a credential, plus the full benefits summers. So, you know, are the salaries that bad? Are unions really dead? They are slowing down because a lot of people have concerns about them, but certainly they are still alive and well. And let us be equal opportunity to looking at all the different countries in the world. Not only does America have superiority in many ways in the workplace relative to Asia and the Middle East and Saudi Arabia, Africa, but let's not forget about Latin America. Farm workers in America, they may make low salaries, but they are paid regularly, and they rarely are forced to live in corrugated metal shacks. But that is not the case just south of the U.S. border, according to a recent L.A. Times report, where they say they make them work all summer and don't pay them sometimes ever, and they do live in corrugated shacks. So, as we approach Christmas, might we want to save a little good cheer for the U.S. employer? Should we indeed feel gratitude rather than resentment? Net, while we can certainly find fault, have we perhaps underappreciated the U.S. workplace? Barbara Nemco, your reactions.
Well, I certainly agree. I think this is all part of appreciating the country we live in. It's not just about the workplace. It is a country that tries to take care of everybody and make sure that everybody has their health needs taken care of, whether or not they can afford to pay for it, and make sure that people don't go hungry. If we don't do it with the government, we do it with charities. My view is probably somewhat slanted by living in Napa, where we spend most weekends attending fundraisers for one nonprofit or another.
And it's not that we're doing it. There is They're massive. Hundreds and hundreds of people going to multiple fundraisers all over Napa. Yeah.
There are something like 400 plus nonprofits in Napa County, which is not a very big county. And they all are in need of money. They came up with something this year called the Give Guide, where you can go online and there are 40 nonprofits that you can contribute to, even if you only have $10 to give.
Staying focused on the workplace, what are your thoughts about my rant, if you will?
Well, those are all true. I would emphasize the fact that we don't have child labor. We have laws against that, so we don't have little kids having to work in sweatshops from the time they wake up in the morning until the sun goes down at night,
you
7
know,
days a week.
I got it. Always a contrarian. When I was recently at a Chinese restaurant and at a Mexican restaurant, and the children were working there, and you know what? They were so excited, so happy. I had a kid who was 8 years old take my money for a burrito. And write out my order and hand it to, you know, so I'm not a big fan of rules. I'm a big fan of individual decision making. And once you have blanket rules, I think we need to take a harder look at the cost benefit of each of those rules.
Well, we have blanket rules which didn't stop this family from allowing their 8-year-old to work in their cafe. But what I'm talking about are the factories where people can drop their children and the children are treated as slave labor. And I'm very grateful we don't have that.
Fair enough.
I'll tell you another one that occurred to me. When my mother turned 65, she was required to retire.
Mm.
And those were the worst years of her life. She, in fact, died only a few years later, and I swear it was largely because she had a broken heart. She didn't know what to do with herself. She loved working, and we no longer have those mandatory retirements. So I'll never face having to retire because of age. We have the choice, yes, and we have benefits that kick in when you get to that age, but they don't make you retire. And that's a good thing today because a lot of people are staying in the workplace longer, many of them coming back out of retirement to work because work adds immeasurably to the quality of people's lives.
Your point is excellent. And in fact, studies show that the average person lives only 24 months after retirement. Now, of course, some of
that, for my mom,
some of that comes from the fact that you don't retire very often. You don't retire until you are sick. But it's not just that. You feel empty. When you feel useless, you lose your will to live. So, yes, when in doubt, please, you know, stay employed. And importantly, as Barbara pointed out, the ending of mandatory retirement is probably ultimately very good for the workforce, good for the nation, and good for individuals.
My dad, to continue with this point, after he retired, stared out the window for 2 years. Had no idea what to do with himself. He was a pharmacist, and suddenly he had nowhere to go, nothing to do, nobody to talk to except my mother. And the two of them locked in a small apartment was not a good thing. And then he ended up as a former pharmacist getting a job as a runner on Wall Street, where he was happier than he had ever been in his entire professional career because the camaraderie of having breakfast with all the guys and then they would jump on trains and go deliver packages or whatever they did. They'd get together again for lunch. It was wonderful. So work, there's something I'm grateful for. Work gives us a social outlet as well as the feeling of contributing.
You're listening to The Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. The topic, should we be net grateful or resentful about the American workplace? But now we'd like to invite you to join the discussion. If you have an opinion, we've heard both Barbara and me opine. If you'd like to opine, we invite you to call here on this pre-Christmas show. You might err on the side of gratitude, given that it is Christmas. We can be curmudgeonly most of the year, but maybe it's time to bury the inner Scrooge, Grinch, whatever. But no. You know, we are an equal opportunity radio show here. Whatever your perspective, whether you think America sucks or it's great, the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We already got a caller on the line, so let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. What is on your mind?
Hi, yes, this is Harry calling from San Francisco. And
hi, Harry.
I guess you two live in a different world than I do because I don't see people being well taken care of by their employers. I see quite a few of them being exploited, Amazon being a case in point, where people were actually picketing in support of what's going on in Germany. And they paid, and people were not being paid, in general, a sufficient wage to take care of their basic needs, so they're going into debt. Tens of millions of people were not going to be covered by the so-called Affordable Care Act, which is actually a subsidy for the HMOs. Although it does provide people that with pre-existing conditions with coverage, that is a good thing. And I see tremendous deprivation here in San Francisco and people being exploited and people being kicked out of their homes and their homes repossessed and so forth, while people are being paid tens of millions of dollars, and total idiots like Peter Thiel are billionaires, or Zuckerberg, while intelligent people are struggling, and the government is bought by corporations and corporate interests, and pensions all over the country are being cut back, and workers are being stigmatized just for having a pension. I think it's a really bad situation here, and I don't see at all that these nonprofits do a good job. Some of them do, but a lot of them, the head of the nonprofit makes over $150,000 a year, which is outrageous, considering they're supposed to be serving the poor.
Anyway, I want to thank you very much for the call. It's important to have a balanced perspective. you want me to, you're looking at me like you want me to say something briefly.
Sure.
I do think that there is, it's easy to paint all things with a broad brush, and I'm guilty of it as well here in trying to make the general case about the average worker. There are probably 20 or 30% of the American people who are doing badly, although still better in much of the world, better than in Bangladesh or Africa or Latin America, but who it's not at random. People don't end up at random where they are. Some of it is luck. There is luck in this world. But the people who choose to not work hard in school or who don't have much impulse control or are not reliable and didn't develop the skills to take hard courses in sciences and in computer science, they're more likely to be the people he's describing, that is, not being, no employer feels they're worth paying him a living wage, let alone with all the benefits that are expensive. And so it is. I'm glad he called, because there certainly are some people who are losers in the game. But net-net, if one calculated the overall work, the U.S. workplace, in terms of the quality of life in people in their workplace, I think it's fair to say that net, relative to the world, and it's not fair to compare us to Finland, which is a very, very different country with a very different population, I think there is, especially around Christmas time, we stipulated to this up front, that this, given the relentless bashing of the workplace and corporations that goes on 52 weeks a year in the media, it felt appropriate to pay homage to them, and I want to pay a little more homage to them in the following sense. And I've said this once before on the radio, but given the passion of the caller, when I think of the corporations that I have dealt with, I have been a consultant to The Gap. And when I go to The Gap, I see thousands of employees in lovely work settings, truly happy about their jobs, with an art museum in the lobby and lovely desks and work-life balance initiatives galore. And they are making middle-class salaries with good benefits. And they're providing an honorable product. And there is a corporate social responsibility where they make sure that there is not sweatshop labor being producing this stuff in Asia. And I've been a consultant to Genentech. And Genentech is very much involved in trying to ensure the not only to ensure the professional and personal development of its people. They hired me and paid me good money to develop a series of tips to help them, help each of the individual people grow. When I think about me as a consumer and my interaction with corporations, Barbara and I have driven Toyotas for 40 years, and we are amazed at how reliable, not built to self-destruct, those Toyotas have been. We average over 200,000 miles for each Toyota we buy, and they are affordable to the middle class, especially if you buy a used one. We have Whirlpool appliances. We moved into our house in Napa 14 years ago, and they put in some pretty basic Whirlpool appliances when the house was built. And we just mentioned yesterday that all of those appliances, 14 years later, are still running perfectly.
My sorrow, because you know I'd love to replace the refrigerator with a modern French door one.
Right.
But I can't get the darn thing to die.
Right. But I think that especially here in the Bay Area, we are very good at focusing on the people who have not succeeded in the world of work. And I think a measure of balance may indeed be appropriate. I'll give out the phone number again. The question that Barbara Nemco and Martin Nemco here on KALW are raising on this pre-Christmas show is net. Should we feel that Christmas value of gratitude or resentment, net-net, about the U.S. workplace? We are eager to hear your opinion. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And back to the phones. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello.
Hi, my name's Rich.
Hi, Rich.
I would say that I'm net negative. And although I'm very happy to be doing better than most of the rest of the planet, I see that we've been regressing rather than progressing for the past 40 years. It seems to be that this all kind of began when Ronald Reagan came in, and it's been real wages have just declined since then, and they've been concentrated at the not only the top 1%, but the top, you know, 0.1 or 0.01%. At the turn of the last century, the Vanderbilts and the railroad barons and the Rockefellers and et cetera were taken care of with antitrust legislation, and it seems like government has forgotten, like everyone has forgotten about this, and it's you know, rather than if I were just grateful for the fact that I'm doing better than the rest of the planet, then I feel like I would be complacent not to try to affect change to get it back going in the other direction again.
It's interesting that you've placed the blame on Reagan. Actually, the rate of accelerative difference between rich and poor has exacerbated over the last 5 years. And one, I'm not blaming Obama for it at all. I think politicians, while they do have enormous influence, I think there are other factors that are really major, that are operative. It used to be in the earlier decades that the skills required to make a middle class living were lower level. You could work and basically do lower level things and still make a middle class living. Now you have to be darn smart. So much technology is involved, so much more critical thinking. It's just harder for people for an entire nation to do that. And so while I think that certainly we can play the soundbite of the fact that stock options went up in the 1990s and 2000s, so CEOs, you know, made a lot of money, I'm not convinced it can be laid at any one source, although I think that probably at this point in the arc of history, you're probably right that we probably need to do more, because the middle class is hollowing out, and there isn't. And I've done a number of shows where I've tried to find out an answer for how to rebuild that hollowed out middle class. I think because there is no easy answer, even entrepreneurship, which is the most commonly given answer, because entrepreneurship creates new jobs, it's not eating seed corn, I think that there probably is in the need for some more redistribution to the poor, because job training programs have proven not to work very well. So I agree with your net statement that we shouldn't just compare ourselves to the rest of the world, but we probably need to do some redistribution. And on that, at this point in time, Barbara Nemco.
Well, there is an article in the local paper this morning. A woman went in and had a blood test done at the local hospital. And for the blood test, she was charged $3,100 and something. And she said, "This is insanity. How can that be? I went to Quest Diagnostics and had a blood test, and they charged me $24 or whatever they charged." And the head of the hospital wrote an editorial this morning explaining it, and he said, "As the local hospital, we take care of everybody, and we get less and less reimbursement from the government. So the only way to do it is shift the cost to the patients who can pay. And we have to do that for the good of the community." So if you look at the fact that everybody is taken care of, and we are redistributing all the time. There's tremendous redistribution going on, and people in other countries don't get that kind of taking care of.
And that's why Obamacare people are yelling and screaming. They're finding that if you're not subsidized and you're trying to get health insurance through the Obamacare exchanges, your rates are going to go up because it's cost shifting. You're going to be paying for the many poor people who are subsidized.
And old sick people.
And when illegals, you know, President Obama's number one domestic priority in 2014 is comprehensive immigration reform. Currently, the illegal immigrants are not covered under Obamacare, but when they are going to be covered, and they are going to be mainly subsidized because they don't have a lot of money, and therefore the costs of people who are paying premiums is going to go up even more. But let's get other people's perspectives.
We're sounding very Scrooge-like for this Christmas show.
I think we spent the first part of the show listing example after example after example.
And nobody agreed with us, so
no,
let's see.
The listen, we're trying to be filled with
good
balance
cheer.
Of positive and good cheer. Let's go to the phones. Let's see if our next caller, I'll just be neutral and say what his or her perspective is. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello.
Hi, is this me?
It is.
Hi. I just think that probably I would have to agree with the first two callers and unfortunately disagree with you. I mean, in a way, it seems like saying should we be grateful or resentful is a kind of a false dichotomy. On the one hand, if we sit and say we'll be grateful, you know, we're going to sit around and rest on our laurels and forget about all the enormous social problems that there are. And so, for example, to compare our country with other countries and to say, well, look at how much more advanced we are, it's not as good a comparison as to say something like, well, what kind of potential do we have to be? Maybe we should compare ourselves with the ideal of what we should be and look at how far short of the mark we fall. So I'm not advocating being resentful, but I just think that, you know, if we're to say, oh, let's all be grateful for this wonderful la-la situation that we're in, maybe it would be a better option to say, let's look at what the good things we have, the positive things we have, but we need to continue to be vigilant because, you know, like one of the callers that came on, I think it was the last one, said, you know, the last 30 years we've seen the complete decimation of our social system. We've seen the rise in corporate power. You know, we've seen the big five media companies owning, you know, all the media. We've seen the deregulation of the financial industry. So those are all things I think we should continue to be vigilant about, but we shouldn't be resentful.
A fair point. I'm curious if there was one initiative that you would think would represent the not sitting on our laurels, but you would see as an improvement for humankind worldwide or in America in terms of the workplace, what would that one initiative be in your mind?
Oh, I can tell you right away. We need to make corporations illegal, and we need to give workplaces over to the workers. We need worker-owned co-ops and workplaces. We continue to have a free market. It can continue to be laissez-faire capitalism, just like we had. I'm not advocating socialism, but we've got to give the corporations and the companies over to the workers that run them.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. I'm curious, you know, we briefly mentioned corporations like Toyota or Whirlpool. I wonder what would happen if there was no corporation and the workers, you know, I wanted to do a show here on worker co-ops, the Arizmendi Baking Company that's worker-owned, Rainbow Grocery that is worker-owned. It was something that began in the 60s and has really died out because most of them, when the workers ran them, they didn't run well. Do you think that the net benefits, Barbara Nemco, of if, for example, Toyota was not run by its leaders but run by its workers, or Whirlpool was run by its workers, or a pharmaceutical company that makes the drug you take to reduce the symptoms of menopause were made by the workers. I can't help it. I just felt like saying that. I don't know.
Thank you so much.
Do you think net, in terms of the impact on humankind, do you think that would be a net positive or negative?
I think the likelihood is that the workers, in their desire to make sure that everybody had everything they needed, might likely run the corporation into the ground because they would not want to make the hard decisions in terms of the required productivity of given workers. People who had larger families would be getting more benefits. People who needed to, I just think they would be all heart and less head. And I think you need both in a corporation.
You know, human beings, we tend to use the word corporation to hide the fact that a corporation really consists of two very large groups of people. It is not only the employees. You know, and many of my clients are both middle-level people and high-level people, or human beings who are also trying to strike the balance between profitability and humans, but also shareholders. And shareholders are everything from, you know, the callers seem to be very much an anti-corporate nonprofit bias. So, for example, you know, PERS, which provides retirement and college saving plan benefits for workers who are everything from janitors in the SEIU to teachers in the American Federation of Teachers, everybody who puts aside money to save for their college education, their children's college education, or their retirement, are owners, literally owners of Toyota, Amazon, Google.
So we are the corporations.
So essentially, many of us are. Now, I'm well aware that there are certain people who can't afford to invest anything in corporations and who are not employees of corporations and who don't buy products that are corporate and they want to buy locally in small stores and buy handcrafted hemp clothes, literally and metaphorically. But net, it seems all three callers were painting with a very, very broad brush. It was corporations bad, people good. And I like to think that maybe it's a little more nuanced than that. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. All our lines are lighted up, so I think we're just going to keep taking more calls and use them as the trigger for conversation. Welcome to Work with Marty and Barbara. What's on your mind?
Well, first I'd like to say, if you're born in this country, you've already hit a sort of a jackpot compared to a lot of countries, and I've been to many countries. Now, I retired very early, extremely early. I'll be 75 in July. Now, what I'd like to suggest to some of your listeners, start preparing for retirement early. Start thinking about relocating to a less expensive home or an apartment or a different region. Don't get your total satisfaction in life, your whole identification in life, from your job. You can join organizations, you can do volunteer work, you can do many things that would give you lasting happiness and not dependent on retirement age.
Yeah. Anyway, I want to thank you for the call. It's a little off topic, so I'm going to go, but it was some point that he made that was related that is interesting. There was a caller last week, I remember, to the show who was very angry about the fact that there were people who had lived in the Bayview of San Francisco who no longer can afford to and had to move out to Antioch or Pittsburgh because of the gentrification that's going on in that area. And there was something about that that was reminiscent of this caller who talked about moving to a lower-cost area. Is the understandable desire to protect workers who are the most vulnerable, is it really, should it be a right? He was calling for major government legislation that would prohibit those, you know, would protect the rents of those people living in the Bayview so they didn't have to move out. Is it really a right to live in San Francisco, the most expensive, beautiful place on earth? It feels like this is a little out of balance, Barbara.
As someone who was born in New York, the thought of living in Manhattan was always something that I knew I couldn't do. And that goes back 50 years ago.
You were in the Bronx. People don't
born in the Bronx, that's right.
The Bronx is kind of a poor area in New York.
The Bronx is up and the battery's down. But Manhattan is the place that people think of when they think of New York City.
Yeah.
That's where you want to be. That's where everything is happening.
Right.
But rents in Manhattan were always beyond the reach of most middle-class people. And as a young teacher making a big $5,300 a year, we knew if we wanted a house, we would have to move further away. And so my first house was in Commack, Long Island, which was
middle of nowhere,
far out.
Farm country.
That's right. So the notion that everybody is entitled to live anywhere they want and the rent should be affordable, I think, is reaching. I think we expect everything from the government and the society, and that's not realistic.
Let me try to take a more liberal stance for a moment, again, to try to provide a little balance between us, because it seems like we're taking the non-liberal stance with regard to the callers. I do believe, as I said to an earlier caller, that because the middle class is so hollowed out, and many formerly middle class people are now making minimum wage, and minimum wage still only around $10 an hour, that while it is true that if we raise the minimum wage, some people will lose jobs because many employers will say this person is simply not adding $15 an hour worth of value. That's true, but there also are in certain corporate, let's even take the fast food industry, where profits are pretty high in the McDonald's of the world. And if they were forced to pay $15 an hour to their workers, would net society be better? I think the answer is yes. I think somebody willing to work 40 hours a week in a fast food restaurant, probably McDonald's would not fire those workers. They would absorb the cost. And yes, the shareholders, we would lose something out of that. The stock price would go down, a dividend would go down, all that.
Prices might go up
probably,
and people wouldn't eat there so often,
true.
Which would be a good thing. They wouldn't be obese.
Yeah, they would probably raise the prices at McDonald's, which would ironically hurt the poor, who are the main ones who shop there. You know, if Walmart was forced to pay $15 or $20 an hour, raise them. But net, somehow I think that even for perception reasons only, I somehow think that raising the minimum wage to a living wage net is a good thing. I think that there is certainly a disgruntlement, a perception, especially you can hear from the KLW listeners, that there is something fundamentally unfair. Yes, they're the top 0.1% of making millions, but there are very few who make those millions. Most,
and they pay most of the taxes.
The top 5% pay 59% of the federal income tax. But I think that there is such a perceived unfairness that net-net, I think that in 2014, America would be better if we had a living wage increase, raise of the minimum wage to a, quote, living wage regionally adjusted. One guy's opinion. Let's go back to the phones, take another couple calls, then we have a surprise guest. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, dear. Marty, I don't think you intend to, but you often come across as let them eat cake.
As,
and if I could just finish my point.
As what? What did you say?
Feel free to lambaste me, but I think most of us feel that things are really out of whack and that we're caught in a catch-22. That is, we don't know how to get out of the situation where there's such gross imbalance. CEOs' salaries, hundreds of times what the average worker makes, and they don't pay most of the taxes. I know because I've been close to more than one.
No, I've got, you know what, I've got to disagree. And, no, excuse me, no. When there's an actual, opinions, I have not interrupted a single caller, but I happen to be very knowledgeable about the statistics. It is a correct fact that the top 5% of income earners in America pay 59% of the federal income tax. That's not to dispute.
All right. Well, let me see if I can bring up some more information about that, and if I do, I will send it to you. Also, there are hundreds of companies in the U.S. alone, never mind Europe and Asia, that are worker-owned, that work perfectly well. They don't rule more with the heart than the head because, you know, they're employees and also directors. These notions are just, I don't know where you get them. And referring back in time to another time when people worked hard and, you know, they didn't rely so much on luck, which plays a huge role in success. It's been demonstrated again and again.
Luck
and
does I know matter. From, yeah.
And
it sure does.
I know from my own friends and family that the ones who own homes early are the ones who had help from their family members.
But did those family members get that way for random? If I, for example, I have worked 60 hours a week my whole life. I grew up in a tenement in the Bronx. And if I choose to help use the results of the of my work to help my daughter, is that a bad thing? Should I be punished
no.
for that?
I'm just saying.
Okay. I want to thank you for the call. I'm looking at the clock, and I want to take one more call before. But thank you for the call, Barbara Nemco.
No, I have...
Nothing you were looking
Nothing
like
I
you,
want to add. No, I was looking
you
like
You were shaking
that.
Your head. I was wondering what that was. Okay. All right. Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. Are we going to be 5 for 5 and 5 people calling Barbara and Marty Grinches?
You bet, Marty. I think that, you live, you're a little out of touch with the way the average person actually has to live. I personally work in IT. And supporting the same systems for going on 18 years. And my employer outsourced my systems to a consulting company 5 years ago. And that consulting company primarily uses India labor to accomplish most of its goals. I haven't seen a raise.
Isn't it racist to claim that a worker in India has less right to a job than you?
I hope you'll let me finish making
Please
my
do,
point.
But you made a pretty racist
there's
comment
there. A couple
there.
Of things that I think you need to bear in mind, Monty, that are critical in the way you perceive the world. You talked about McDonald's a moment ago. McDonald's spent nearly $16,000 per employee this year, or maybe last year, to do stock buybacks to increase the value of its stock so that it's the CEO would make more money on his stock. That is the way the company pays him. Okay, so these companies have ways of putting more money into the hands of consumers, the workers, the people that are really earning the company its money. The company could be paying these workers more money, but you know, once one company does it, then another company has to do it, and none of them want to do it because their priority is towards their priority is for their shareholders.
If I might interrupt the caller for just one minute, I think the point that Marty made was that he thinks that they should be paid living wage. There should be salary increase. But I didn't hear you say that. Just in case you hadn't heard that.
That was about the most, that was the, When you said that, that was the one thing that you've said in the last year of listening to you that I could agree with you 100% on. There was another point I was going to make about McDonald's. And related to stock is that 5% of the people in our population own 85% of the stock market. So when you want to point to the stock market and people's ownership of stock as being some sort of positive American value, very few people actually own stock, and I personally have all my retirement money wrapped up in the stock market. You know, it's not an investment for me. It's sort of a way of saving that's supposed to grow that money, and it's very volatile. That's because companies took away the planned retirement plans in order to increase their profits and put the burden on the worker to save for their retirement. And I'm fortunate that I've made enough money in the last 20 years nearly to have saved a little bit of money for retirement. And I'm also fortunate because I own a house in San Francisco. But I think it's a little Pollyanna-ish to look at my situation or for you guys to look at your situation and, hey, we're doing okay. Last point I'll make is comparing the U.S. workers or the poverty in the U.S. to the worst examples in the world for poverty or the way people work isn't fair to the U.S. worker. We have plenty of money in this country that people at the top have increased their share of the money 300% in the last 30 years. And I make $90,000 a year, but that's basically the equivalent to $25,000 that my dad was making in 1980, raising four kids and owning a house in San Diego. So I think you guys need to get out more and get out of Napa, maybe, and talk to people that are actually working, doing the dirty jobs in San Francisco.
Thank you for the call. There is something was very implicit in, I don't know how much of the show he listened to. We talked about the fact that there is some concern about the income gap between the richest and the poorest. But I think it is fair, again, this broad brush notion that, instead of repeating myself, I'm going to simply say a new point. There is a common thread among all of the callers, and is that all people are equally worthy, and that if a shareholder is somebody and his statistic about 5% of the people own 85% of the stock is very, very misleading, because your average middle class person does have his or her money invested in a mutual fund or a stock in their retirement plan or a personal savings plan. And yes, it's volatile, but every study has shown that that volatility results in net an increased amount of income over time. So in fact, it enables working and middle class people to make more money. But my core point is this assumption that all of the KALW callers today believe that all people are equally entitled. Is it really, if we are truly honest, instead of saying what feels nice, if we really ask ourselves whether the person who ended up in a fast food restaurant working in McDonald's flipping burgers, who probably did not work hard in school, who is more likely, certainly some of them are saints, but are more likely to have developed drug problems, more likely to have gotten pregnant at 14, more likely to have not worked hard in school, more likely to have not deferred gratification and gone to college, more likely to have been difficult to work with, more likely to have not been responsible. Is that person really more worthy than a shareholder who is a teacher or a union plumber or somebody who is invested in McDonald's stock and therefore can save for his or her child's college education or retirement? I don't think there is an easy answer. I'm not saying, shareholder good, worker bad, but I'm sensing a lack of nuance that is disturbing, that I think that if there is any Christmas message that should be heard by all of us is, I don't remember who was the famous philosopher who said anybody who's too sure of themselves is wrong. Things are more nuanced than I'm afraid. I'm feeling dispirited by the black and whiteness of the callers. There's more nuance. We've tried hard to present both sides, but And I'll leave it at that. So now, Barbara, let's turn to, we have our surprise guest. We only have 10 minutes before we have our Christmas song that we will have rewritten the words to. But would you please introduce him and tell him why he's here?
I would love to. This is someone I think we can all agree on. I had the privilege of being a judge for the Youth Entrepreneurship Program last week. And this is a program where high school and college students develop a business plan. They submit the written business plan, and the best are selected to do a live presentation to a panel of judges. There's a high school competition and a college competition. And for the second year in a row, the high school competition was won by the same student, Nicholas Dagan, who developed a plan that sold us on the idea that this could work, would work. And when Nicholas entered last year, he was a sophomore in high school and did this not even as part of a class, just something that interested him. So I thought it would be wonderful to showcase how some young people are thinking, working very hard in school. And so Nicholas is here with us this morning.
Welcome, Nicholas. And before I ask you some questions, I do think in light of the dramatic tenor of the previous calls, I can just hear those same listeners thinking, well, again, we're cherry picking winners. And, you know, entrepreneurship is merely going to create more corporations. And I would like to point out that from the left to the right, it is agreed, while there is certainly debate about the need for Keynesian stimulus, government stimulus in the short run to try to jumpstart the economy, there is unanimity across the spectrum that the only way to create permanent good jobs is new businesses. Because new businesses create new desires from the public, new need to create products and services, new need to manufacture and distribute them, etc. So ultimately, because if we just use taxpayer dollars, we are going to reduce the money available to start new businesses. So entrepreneurship is something that is something of value, not just to the winners, but ultimately to all of us. And so now, Nick, thank you very much for joining me on Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So what was the first nanosecond you were aware that you wanted to do something to do with starting a business?
Well, I was in my digital media class, which is an ROP class at Napa High School, and we had a presenter come in and tell us about entrepreneurship. He was from the Napa Valley College, Charlie Monahan, and he told us about how important business is to the Napa economy and all that it does. And he mentioned this plan that we could take a part of, this competition, and I decided to go for it, and I'd give it a shot. So I went ahead and researched the entrepreneurship, what it was about, and all the sorts of things that you could do. And I eventually settled on creating a food truck business, something that wasn't too ambitious, but something that I could do with my own capital and just a little bit of investment. So I managed to plan it all out, and I set it up, built a plan, submitted it to the competition, and it was selected as a finalist to present.
Now, food trucks were big in 2010, and they've become overcrowded, so it's a much more competitive market. What was your plan to make your food truck viable in an ever more competitive market?
Okay, so I saw that the fast food market was very unhealthy, like McDonald's and whatnot. And even the food trucks in Napa have some pretty unhealthy food, like the tacos and whatnot, a lot of fried food. And so my idea, the fresh part of the name, was to have all this locally grown produce as part of my food. I put it all together the morning of, and it's all fresh and ready to go.
Great. I just mentioned parenthetically, one of the many digs that the callers gave was, you must get out of Napa. Napa has got about 50% of kids on free lunch. We have a majority minority population there with a large number of farm workers. So I think it's a little unfair to denigrate Napa as only an enclave of the rich. It was just one of many, frankly, outrageous statements that were made. So that was your first. And do you actually think about creating that food truck, or is that just an idea that's in theory?
Well, this first plan, making the food truck, certainly was to start with, was a theory. You know, I was building the plan for this hypothetical contest, but I most recently created a business for the competition and won with it, A-plus tutoring.
I'm going to let you, before we get to that, I'm going to pretend like I, you know, you see the TV show The Shark Tank, and, you know, I'm going to pretend that I'm a venture capitalist.
Okay.
And I'm going to say to you the following. Do you know that starting a food truck costs about $100,000, both because of the truck and the equipment, and because the regulations for food in California are mammoth? Had you considered that in your business plan? And should you, if you were to think of starting a business like that?
Well, certainly. I went into the financials and I found the cheap little white truck on Craigslist, and I found it for like $18,000.
Okay.
And I managed to plan out all my startup costs, and it came out to be around $35,000.
Good for you. I like the fact that you were buying used. That's very good. How are you going to source your fruit and keep it fresh? That's going to be, you know, you'd have to do a lot of accurate guessing about the cost of the fruits and vegetables in the beginning until you know how much you're going to be able to sell. How are you going to avoid a lot of wastage?
Well, I discussed this with my business advisor, Charlie Monahan, the guy who came in to speak with us. And we decided that we would go around to the local farms in Napa, like in Carneros and whatnot. And he managed to find out some numbers. I didn't actually go out and do it myself, but I heard it from him, and he found some. And we put it together, and we found out that we wouldn't actually be purchasing a kitchen. We wouldn't be buying any real estate to do the assembling of the food ourselves. We would be renting out a commercial kitchen, which would reduce our overhead and keep our business a low-risk, low-investment mobile endeavor.
What if I were to argue that driving around to the local farms for the small quantity you're going to need in terms of gas and the labor and the wear and tear on the truck was too great, and that you really would be smartest to end up going to an inexpensive supermarket and buying your stuff fresh each morning and let them do the work? What do you think?
Well, I don't think our target market really wants to hear that. I mean, the people who are coming to come to a business like Fast and Fresh are really interested in helping the environment and going organic. I think that they're willing to pay more to get what we provide.
Good answer. Good answer. Now let's talk about your second. So the next year you went and you created this Ace Plus tutoring business. Tell us about how there's lots of tutoring websites available where people can go online and get tutoring that you can call you can ask your kids' teacher for a recommendation for a tutor. What's special about your tutoring business?
Okay. Well, I'd like to say that it's a one-on-one peer-based tutoring business. It's mainly for high school students, and it's tutored by high school students, highly qualified ones. And so that eliminates the generational gap between tutor and student.
Good.
Which creates a more relaxed learning environment.
Yes.
And also, it's also low investment, like my other business. We're not going to be purchasing an actual place to be doing the tutoring. We're going to have our tutors drive to a location to meet the students and teach them there.
And what about the concern that parents have, first of all, that a kid tutoring, what if it's, you know, there's insurance issues? We unfortunately know about there's abuse issues. If a guy's tutoring a girl, what if he comes over to tutor her and he rapes her? Or what about the fact that he may not have the expertise? He's a peer. He's just taken algebra himself. What if he's going to teach wrong stuff rather than a credentialed teacher?
Okay. Well, our tutors are highly qualified. I had a rigorous selection process. Each student is a high school student and has over a 4.5 grade point average.
Wow.
They have to be over 16. They have to be able to drive to places, so they'll have their own car, a driver's license, and proof of insurance. We'll also be purchasing errors and omissions insurance for each of our tutors, so that in case a student feels that, like, we didn't prepare them well enough for a test, we won't have to worry about finding funds for that. We can just have the insurance.
Sounds great. I want to ask you, I've asked you a hard question. You've done a really good job. I'm really proud of you, and you should be proud of yourself is more important. I want to ask you a softball question. What is one other thing you want to tell our listeners, whether they be 16 or 76, who are contemplating starting a business, that you want to say honestly, something that's really a real truth that you think our listeners should hear?
I think you really need to plan out your business thoroughly before you go out and start it. I was doing small tutoring around my neighborhood and was thinking about expanding way before I made this plan, A-plus tutoring, during summer. And I tried to expand. I put out some flyers, and it just didn't work. You know, the scheduling was really erratic, and I couldn't get people going. Couldn't get it all organized. I really just couldn't do it myself. So it was really helpful to plan it out and figure out the size and scope of my business before I started it.
Sounds great. Barbara, make a little capstone, little comment or something, if you would.
Nicholas was very persuasive. And one of the things that sold me as a judge was when he said that students don't like to be tutored in their school because everybody sees them. There's a stigma in doing that, or even going to a commercial tutoring place. You don't want to be seen going into Sylvan Learning. But if the tutor comes to your house, you feel more relaxed, which makes you more receptive to what's being taught. And the fact that it's somebody who has likely been in a class just like yours and has a really good recency effect of what you will be required to know, that helps in terms of getting the student prepared for the class that they're taking.
Okay. Now, to kind of capstone the pre-Christmas show, something kind of a tradition here on Work with Marty Nemko, I have rewritten the words to the 12 Days of Christmas, and we're going to have everybody who's in the studio here, Eric Wayne, my engineer, Nicholas and his parents who are here, my guest, and Barbara Nemko and I are going to sing the revised version, the Baudelaireized version of the 12 Days of Christmas, and I will accompany on the piano. So, okay, here we go.
On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a boss that won't drive me insane. On the second day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 2 days telecommuting and a boss that won't drive me insane. On the third day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 3 mentors calling, 2 days uncommuting, and a boss that won't drive me insane. On the fourth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 4-minute commutes, 3 mentors calling, 2 days telecommuting, and a boss that won't drive me insane. On the fifth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 5-star reviews, 4-minute commutes, 3 mentors calling, 2 days commuting, and a boss that won't drive me insane. On the sixth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 6 perks are coming, 5-star reviews, 4-minute commutes, 3 mentors calling, 2 days telecommuting, and a boss that won't drive me insane. On the seventh day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 7-day Maui training, 6 perks are coming, 5-star reviews, 4-minute commutes, 3 mentors calling, 2 days telecommuting, and a boss that won't drive me insane. On the eighth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 8 smart co-workers, 7-day Maui training, 6 perks, 5-star reviews, 4-minute commutes, 3 mentors calling, 2 days telecommuting, and a boss that won't drive me insane. On the ninth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 9 funny colleagues, 8 gardener workers, 7 Maui training, 6 perks are coming, 5-star reviews, 4-minute commutes, 3 mentors calling, 2 days telecommuting, and a boss that won't drive me insane.
And we have to stop. I'm looking at the clock. Unfortunately, it's the 20th, so you're going to have to live without 10 real big raises, 11 meetings canceled, and 12-month sabbatical. But I know I speak for Barbara Nemko, for Nick, my guest, and his parents, certainly wishing you all a very happy whatever tradition you choose to celebrate. Anyway, and that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Eric Wayne, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in, whether you agree with me or disagree with me, and Barbara. Please join me again next Sunday, 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers and my career and workplace predictions for 2014. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
Marty Nemko's 2,000 articles are free on his website. From there, you can also email him if you'd like coaching on your career or to comment on this program. His site is Marty Nemko, NEMKO.com. That's Marty, MARTY, NEMKO.com. Join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco.